Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we continue our look at the decisions made by the Supreme Court this week, and we'll be doing them again next week, by the way. We're going to take another look at what we're about to talk about now, which is affirmative action in a conversation about race and class next week and where they intersect, which we'll also be talking about here. And then next Tuesday at 9 a.m., Sherilyn Ifill, the new president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, will be joining us at 9 o'clock to talk about that next Tuesday morning as well. But we are launching into it right here. It was an incredibly interesting article written in ProPublica by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's their investigative reporter covering civil rights. She joins us by phone. Cheryl Woods in the studio, criminal defense attorney, owner of the Wood Law Firm, a former state and federal prosecutor. Michael Higginbotham is with us as well. He stays with us here for the rest of the hour. The Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law and author of the book Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, Post-Racial in quotes. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to be here.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, leave your comments there. I'll go back to those and see if anyone has a comment on this, as well as tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Before we turn to Nicole, Michael Higginbotham, run down again what this decision means and what just happened.
Well, the Fisher case was a case brought by Louise Fisher against the University of Texas. They have an affirmative action program, which is uses race as a factor in undergraduate admissions. And what the court did on Monday is basically to reaffirm Justice O'Connor's judgment ruling, her last opinion before she stepped down from the bench in 2003 in the Grutter decision. They basically reaffirmed the approach of the Supreme Court to look at any race classification in higher education under a strict scrutiny approach. And so they review it basically saying that it can be done. Affirmative action, race can be used as a factor, providing you meet certain requirements of strict scrutiny, which basically is that you must have a compelling government interest to do so and that the program must be narrowly tailored to satisfy that interest. And basically what the court said on Monday in the Fisher case was that you still have a compelling government interest to create diversity in higher education. And so the University of Texas has satisfied the first prong in terms of a compelling government interest of diversity in higher education. What they said was, though, under the narrow tailoring aspect, that too much deference was given by the lower court to the University of Texas in determining that it used good faith and it exhausted all race-neutral means before it turned to using a race program. And so the court sent it back down, the Supreme Court sent it back down to the lower court to make certain that University of Texas acts consistently with that narrow tailoring aspect. And so that's the decision. It basically reaffirms the court's approach in Grutter and Gratz from 2003, but makes it a little bit more difficult for universities to implement affirmative action programs.
It can make it very difficult. And there are two issues here, one about class, race, and the other that I want to get into, which has to do with just what this has changed and why it's changing politically and socially in America. But, Nicole, I mean, you wrote a very powerful piece, I thought. I was really taken by what you wrote in ProPublica about the debate over class and race. And because, as you wrote, majority of Americans look at class as the defining factor as opposed to race, but because we don't really get into the nuances of race and what race does to change the nature of education and people's opportunities. So please talk a little bit about what you wrote about.
So leading up to the Fisher decision, there's been a lot of talk, particularly coming from progressives, about needing to move to a more fair system, that race-based affirmative action is kind of standing on its last legs, and we need to find something that would replace that, but something that's more fair. And people believe that what's more fair is to look at class, socioeconomic class, as a determinant for who should receive these preferences. So I decided to kind of examine that notion and see if actually a class-based system would produce the same diversity at schools and if it actually is a more fair system. And if you just look at statistics, you find that the experiences of Black Americans and Latinos who are poor typically are very different from those of poor white Americans, and that there actually is an advantage if you're poor to being white. The typical poor white student doesn't attend a high poverty school. They attend a middle income school, which means they have access to more college prep curriculum. They have access to more experienced and qualified teachers, whereas the typical Black and Latino student attends a school where two-thirds of the students are poor, and that comes with less experienced teachers. Many of them don't have access to higher-level classes, and that means that when they're applying for admission and they're taking these standardized tests, it's very difficult for them to compete and get the same test scores because they're underprepared. And also that even middle-class Black Americans are tending to live in neighborhoods that are more poor and more stressed than lower-class white Americans. So class alone isn't going to reduce these discrepancies.
And the politics of this also is something I think we have to wrestle with. Now, I want folks to join us here at 410-319-8888 because this really has – this ruling, it seems to me, is going to make it, A, very difficult for schools to create affirmative action based on race in America in the future. And B, one of the things it hit me is that you see the language used. And so now that – Civil rights for African Americans in America is being relegated by some to just another interest group, senior citizens, youth, whatever that interest group might be, quote unquote interest group, and that's what it's come down to. And the issue of what race has done to America is trying to be pushed back in this quote unquote post-racial America, Cheryl Woods.
Well, I think there's always a pushback with regards to race, and I think that this case presented an opportunity to kind of expand on and really test what the court decided in Grutter back in 2003. And so now schools like Texas have put into place programs like their Top 10% program that allows them to have some diversity through that program. About 25% Latinos come through it, about 6% African Americans. But this particular woman, Ms. Fisher, fell outside of that. She didn't make that program. And so now it causes the court to look at, well, what about, they put a program into place that's race neutral. We like that. But what about the people who fall outside of that program and the university is still using race as one of the factors to look at those individuals? And now they're sending that back to subject to strict scrutiny. And the hope is for people who are opposed to affirmative action is that these schools will not be able to survive that sort of strict scrutiny and will not be able to have race as a factor at all. Now, there are some, I think this decision being 7-1 really showed that the court could not agree. It's really a compromise for them to do this because obviously they couldn't come to a majority that would go one way or another. And so they came out with this where you have justices such as Justice Thomas and Justice Sotomayor, both in the majority, when they're at opposite polar views.
That was really interesting to watch that happen.
Exactly. And then you have Justice Scalia, who felt like he could sign on because the court in Fisher was not asked to get rid of racial preferences. They weren't asked to do that.
What did Sotomayor say about this on the court? Do we know? What did she have to say, Michael?
Well, I think it's really, really interesting to look at the breakdown. And I think the key was actually Kennedy rather than Sotomayor because Kennedy would not go along with eliminating affirmative action. I think if Justice Kennedy was willing to strike down affirmative action, you would have had a 5-4 decision just like you had in the voting rights case. But what happened is Kennedy basically said, I am going to reaffirm Justice O'Connor's approach in 2003. As a result of that, you ended up with a 7-1 decision getting Thomas as well as other individuals to go along with Justice Kennedy. The really fascinating thing, though, I think you'll see, And basically, I think Sotomayor came along with the seven, as well as Kagan, because what happens is you have the reaffirming of a stare decisis opinion in 2003, a 5-4 decision in Grutter, which says strict scrutiny for affirmative action programs in higher education. And so without overruling that decision, it's easy for most of the justices to simply reaffirm the approach. Fascinating to look, I think, at Justice Ginsburg's dissent, because it's a 7-1 decision. But Justice Ginsburg basically says what the University of Texas did was to satisfy the Grutter decision in 2003. What the 7 in the majority said is, we'll reaffirm the approach, but the University of Texas needs to, in fact, give less deference. I'm sorry, the court needs to give less deference to the University of Texas in terms of whether they acted in good faith to implement this program and whether or not they, in fact, considered all race-neutral alternatives before they implemented race as a factor. So what Ginsburg says is they did exactly what they needed to do under the previous decision, and therefore I dissent from this majority decision in Fisher today. So to me, it's fascinating to look at what Justice Ginsburg said, because really, if you can get 4 justices to go along with her, then you return to the decision that she authored in 2003, which I think is what
fascinating. And so in some ways, Nicole, what you wrote about could very well become the center of the debate in America, driven in some ways on both sides by progressives, class versus race or class than race, but very much used by conservatives to kind of end affirmative action. I mean, we're in a very interesting political time at this moment, Nicole, around this.
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, Americans are more comfortable with the notion of class being the chief disadvantage that people have, because there's a view that you can transcend your class. You can start out poor, but you have the opportunity to become wealthy, whereas you can't change your race. And so we're more comfortable with that. And in some ways, we feel like that's more inclusive. But like I said, the facts simply don't bear out. There are very different experiences. And I interviewed 2 scholars who have been working on this issue for decades, trying to come up with the circumstances that could mitigate race, and they can't do it. You can control for parental education. You can control for wealth. You can control for all of these factors, and there's still a racial element that comes in. And what they've shown is that even under a class-based affirmative action system, what you would get largely are low-income white and Asian students, and you still would see a drop in enrollment of African-American and Latino students, even though they're already vastly underrepresented at the college level.
And, Mark, can I add to that? Because I think what is really so important, and if you look at the voting rights case, it's also something that occurs in the voting area. This affirmative action should be about inclusion. It should be about creating access and opportunity. This argument that has been raised, I think, in the past about a limited pie, and therefore we either need to have race-based programs, race-conscious programs, or we need to have class-conscious. We can't have both. This is about creating opportunities for those who have been deprived. And so, yes, there's race discrimination that continues, so race-conscious programs would be appropriate. Also, there's discrimination against the poor. And so what we need to do is have access and opportunity programs for the poor as well. So it's not about a limited pie. It's about creating access and opportunities for all Americans as we want to encourage all Americans to participate in the democratic process.
I think that's right. Most of the scholars that I talk to, they advocate for both. They say that absolutely poor students of all races are underrepresented on college campuses, and there should be a system of affirmative action that helps those students who come from the most disadvantaged economic backgrounds, but that system cannot replace one of racial affirmative action because these students also have come from a disadvantage.
I agree that both are needed, but I don't want us to miss the importance of this decision and how it's different or goes further than the Grutter decision in 2003. And that is, even though Grutter said strict scrutiny, now the court is implementing that. The court is testing it and sending it back so that the university actually has to put pen to paper and tell people how they engaged in it. And one interesting statement by Justice Kennedy in his majority opinion, his very brief opinion, was that they need to be able to show that there was no workable race-neutral alternatives to what they did in Texas. And that is going to be a very tough standard, I think, for Texas and other universities to adhere to.
I wonder, again, taking it back to the political realm, I'm sitting here with one wonderful journalist and two attorneys, that in some ways, I was thinking a lot about the article that Nicole, that you wrote, that this could be an opportunity, an opportunity for advocates of both class and race in America to come together to talk about our school systems, talk about our public school systems, talk about equality in ways that we don't. I mean, one of the things I think, as you were saying, Nicole, a moment ago, you've got that people are saying, yes, we do have to take class into account because poor people, no matter who they are not represented in our college institutions. And clearly, black folks and Latinos are not represented in our schools and who come from really poor segregated districts. And those things really, in some ways, can be contradictory, but they don't have to be in terms of a mutual struggle for equality in our country. It leaves some room open here.
I think that's a great point. And I think this is a tremendous opportunity. Like Congress has an opportunity now to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, this is an opportunity, I think, for those who are concerned about access and opportunity for all Americans to discuss education and how it's such a legitimate vehicle for upward mobility in our society and that we need to get our education system together. And so to me, it's an important opportunity. And one that I think all people need to understand how critical these affirmative action decisions are because, you know, candidly, when you're talking about the tragic Plessy versus Ferguson case in 1896, Plessy, even though he was separated on the train car, he was going to get off at the same destination as everyone else on that train. When you're talking about cases like Fisher, when you're talking about access and opportunity in higher education, if folks don't get the access and the opportunity, they're not going to end up in the same place as everyone else. And so that's why these education cases like Fisher are so critically important for helping individuals to get a piece of the American dream.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts, folks. I want to hear what you think about the affirmative action ruling. I think we have yet another law professor online here, Doug Colbert. Welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, Mark.
Welcome, Doug.
Hi. How are you? I'm
good.
Sorry I couldn't join you. And I just wanted to make one comment here because I think what we're seeing in both the voting rights cases and in the affirmative action case is a strategy, a plan that's being put forward by Chief Justice Roberts. And I think we have to be really mindful. First, if you don't mind, just a brief comment on the voting rights. That was one of the most radical decisions this Supreme Court has ever made in terms of overruling Congress's determination
yes.
that federal involvement was necessary. And it has to be seen in that context that Roberts had the votes to do that in order to eliminate a federal role and advocate for states' rights. In the education case, he did not have those votes. He did not have the five votes that he wanted, at least five, to overrule Grutter, to overrule the use of race in these decisions. And so I look at Fisher as the step before the next case comes around in which the applic- application of strict scrutiny will ultimately lead Roberts to believe that he now has the votes to undo the use of race in these affirmative action cases. And because Roberts has always been a believer that the way to eliminate race discrimination today is to eliminate the use of race in decisions affecting the admissibility of a student to college and to graduate education.
I appreciate the input, and I think that's what we were talking about earlier as well. There's the politics of this, mm-hmm. And the politics of this court.
And the politics are really coming strong, I think, at this point, because if you look at the next case they took in affirmative action for next year, it's the Sweat case out of Michigan, which basically will allow states pass a referendum to prohibit affirmative action from being utilized. And when that case comes up before the Supreme Court, if they approve that approach, which I think Chief Justice Roberts would like to do, then that could, in fact, eliminate affirmative action because it gives states an opportunity to prevent it.
And that's certainly something that Justice Thomas is interested in having happen, although he concurred, he wrote a concurring opinion in this Fisher case, and he states, among many things, that there isn't a compelling government interest in diversity, in creating diversity in education. And so he's given a preview of where he wants to go, and he wants affirmative action eliminated. And there are others on the court who do as well. And I think that's right. As the professor said, they just didn't have the majority to do it. But that's where they're giving you a preview, just as Justice Thomas gave a preview in the voting rights case, where he said, okay, well, we can get rid of Section 4, but we really should be getting rid of Section 5, too, of the Voting Rights Act. And we're just prolonging the inevitable, he said. So they're giving you a lot of clues as to what they're thinking, and all they need is the right case to do it. And this just wasn't it.
Nicole, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I said go ahead, Nicole, please.
I was going to say, I think what's also interesting is kind of the politics of language when we're dealing with these cases concerning race. So in the ruling, we keep hearing about race-neutral alternatives. Though if you look at the case of University of Texas, their so-called race-neutral alternative is dependent upon racially segregated high schools. So the 10% program only works because Texas has very segregated high schools. And so by drawing the top 10% of a class, you're going to get racial diversity. And we've kind of gotten to this place where, as long as we do not use racially explicit language, the court is asking communities, it's asking colleges to find so-called race-neutral means of producing this diversity. But, of course, the race-neutral means are not race-neutral. And so we've come to kind of play with this language and to deny the racial undertones of language. And really that affirmative action is about addressing a racialized K-12 system. And our K-12 system is very segregated, very racialized. And then when we get to the college level, we're saying we can no longer look at race. We can't consider race.
And one of the interesting studies you had in your article, which we're going to link to on our webpage, was one that showed that middle-class black families, the majority of middle-class black families' children, go to public schools where the majority of kids are poor working-class kids or working-class kids, and the system and the schools themselves are underfunded and don't have the resources other schools do. That was an astounding kind of piece. That I think there are a lot of arguments in the article you raised, Nicole, that I hope get wider play.
Yeah, I think it's when you looked at the oral arguments during the Fisher case, one of the concerns that Samuel Alito raised and that you also hear from progressives is that they believe that affirmative action is benefiting wealthy black kids and Latino kids who don't deserve it. And that's why you should go to a class-based system because, you know, as Alito said, a perfectly ordinary white family is losing out for maybe the child of a doctor. But that's where it's important to understand the way that race impacts your experience, even if you have managed in terms of income to be middle class. African Americans, more than any other group, are not able to turn that income into purchasing into better neighborhoods and better schools. despite having a higher income, they're mm-hmm. still largely living in poor neighborhoods and attending poor schools. So they're not getting those advantages that income is given to other races.
I mean, I think that's right. I do agree. But I think even if the middle class African-Americans, for example, are not living in poor neighborhoods, they're still not given the same access and opportunities, no matter where they live or what they drive, be based upon their race. Even though they might live in the right neighborhood or they might do this or that, it doesn't mean that they're given access necessarily. And so that's why, as you all have stated, and I think we agree, race and class are both important, because if you just do class, you're going to miss out on those middle class, for example, African Americans. And if you just do race, as you said, it will sometimes exclude those who are who their class might, they might fall in a lower class within society. So I agree with that.
I think this is part of the problem with the very narrow window that the Supreme Court is allowing for affirmative action. Past rulings have said that affirmative action cannot be to address racial discrimination. It can't be addressed, used to address kind of ongoing or the history of racial discrimination, but that it only can be used to further the goal of diversity. But of course, diversity is very amorphous, and diversity doesn't necessarily get at that kind of longstanding disadvantage that, as you said, even Black middle-class people who manage to get their kids in better schools still have to deal with. And then when you look at that passage about no workable race-neutral alternatives that would produce the educational benefits of diversity, well, who says what's enough diversity? Who makes that determination? And the University of Texas would say the top 10% didn't provide enough diversity, but it seems like the court is pushing towards, well, you have enough, and you have enough, and therefore introducing race into the equation is unconstitutional. So I think people are in a very difficult space when they're arguing for affirmative action.
About 30 seconds left.
And on that quick point, that's the difference between the Fisher decision and Grutter, because mm-hmm. what the Fisher decision basically says is that courts can no longer give deference to a university's determination that they have exercised race-neutral alternatives.
This has been a great discussion. Michael Higginbotham is the Wilson H. Elkins Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, quotes. Cheryl Wood, criminal defense attorney, owner of the Wood Law Firm, former state and federal prosecutor. Nicole Hannah Jones, investigative reporter covering civil rights at ProPublica in New York City. We'll be linking to our article at steinershow.org. Thank the three of you so much for this enlightening discussion.
Thank you,
Mark.
Thank you.
Good to have you all with us. We're going to take a very brief break, then we're going to come back to look at solitary confinement and new studies, talking about what that does to people who are incarcerated. We're going to get the latest on the Manning trial, and then close out with a conversation on books for our children this summer. Stay with us. We'll be right back.